This is Lori with the Health Department, and today we are pleased to have Mike Grenia from the Vermont Department of Public Safety, who's going to give a talk entitled Fire Safety Issues. Mike is the Assistant Fire Marshal and the Fire Safety Education Coordinator. So we'll do the same thing as we've done in the past. He'll talk for about 10 minutes, and then we'll allow about 10 minutes for questions and answers. And then following the fire safety training, we'll have a brief discussion about pan flu and the role of town health officers for those that are willing and able to stay on.
We'll get going. Everybody hear me okay?
Yeah.
Start off on the slide two. Kind of give you a little bit of brief overview. We don't have a lot of time today to get into a lot of detail, but we wanted to kind of hit upon some highlights and some of the more important things that you folks would see out in the field. So we're going to start off with some facts about fire in Vermont here, and then go into a little bit of a overview of the Division of Fire Safety. We'll talk a little bit about the laws and the what the public building statute means. And then we'll talk a little bit about the fire safety codes, and then we'll end up with the different issues that some of you folks might run into out there and some of the resources that are available. So on the next slide, slide three, you'll see on there some highlights about facts in Vermont here. Heating is the number one cause of fires in Vermont. Now that's related to a lot of our winter activities we have and chimney fires and such of that nature. The rest of the country, cooking is the leading cause. You also see on there that we're considered the most rural state in the United States. That's mainly based on our population levels, of course. The other couple of points there is you see most of our homes in the state were built before 1978. So that itself brings up some common issues and some common problems that we see. Unfortunately, last year we did have 8 fire deaths in the state. The average response time of fire departments statewide is about 6 minutes. Now that's taking into account the department in Burlington here, you know, other departments in rural areas that might have a little bit longer response time, but that's averaging everybody. A couple other points there, you see that the fact that the newer homes that are being built today are much tighter because of energy efficiency, and that they create a issue where a fire will burn hotter and faster. And we also have an issue where we have carbon monoxide buildup in a lot of the homes that where we didn't see that in years past because of the old farmhouses were very drafty and stuff like that. So basically now, right now, we have about 3 minutes to escape a fire. To where in the past, because of the materials we've had in our homes, it was much longer. So about 3 minutes time for someone to escape a fire in their house before they get overcome by the heat and the smoke. And it's the biggest thing is the smoke. Folks don't understand that it's the smoke that is going to get them, not the fire itself. They have a tendency to not be afraid of the smoke, and they'll go right through it and think that's what they've seen on TV. They can put a handkerchief over their face and go running in and all that. So that's, you know, that's on the education end of things. That's kind of what we try to get away from and teach them the truth. So on to the next slide. On slide four is a little bit about the division. The Division of Fire Safety was formed out of a bunch of other state departments and state divisions in the state. They kind of brought together all of the fire-related subjects that we deal with, the fire service training, the hazmat, the state fire marshals that were in labor and industry before, kind of brought them all into one group. So we have a big mission of numerous different areas that we deal in. And on the next slide, on slide five, you see the areas where we have regional offices. We basically have divided the state into quarters, and a regional office handles that corner of the state. So in your towns, you can look at the map and figure out where your regional office is. Then we also have two other offices, the State Fire Academy in Pittsford at the Police Academy. And then we have the central office, which is the main administrative office and stuff like that. Each of the regional offices has fire marshals in them. that cover the towns. There are some municipal, what we call municipal agreements in the larger towns and cities, such as Burlington here, where they have their own fire marshals that go out and do the inspections and stuff like that. Slide six, you see the actual law that talks about the building codes and the hazards from fire. That law is administered by the Commissioner of Public Safety, and the division's fire marshals are the enforcement wing of that. On slide seven, you see the pictures of some books there. Those are the actual codes that we enforce. We have a lot of folks that say, well, just send me a copy of the code. And unfortunately, that's very difficult to do, number one, because they're copyrighted by NFPA. The other part is they're quite thick because they cover all different types of buildings and all different types of occupancies in those books. The one thing that you should be aware of is the yellow book there. That is downloadable on our webpage, and that gives you the Vermont addendums or the changes to those codes that are adopted. We have quite a few changes that are written in there when they're adopted through the legislative process, where we have to change them to make them, unique to our situation here in Vermont. So there's basically three main codes that we use in enforcement of fire codes in the state. First one is NFPA 1, which is the state fire code. That deals a lot with the building itself. That deals with safety measures that are put in place in the building, where NFPA 101, which is the second code, deals more with life safety issues, such as handrails and stuff of that nature. There are other codes that are adopted by reference. For example, electrical issues. These three books do not contain the details on how you need to wire an outlet or what you need for distances. We use another book, which is the National Electric Code. So the NFPA 1 will say has to be installed per the National Electric Code, and that's where you would have the details of that. So there is a tremendous amount of manuals that are in place for those different situations. So we'll move on here real quick. We're doing pretty good on time. And if anybody has some pretty basic questions, we can handle those at the end, like we said. We'll hit upon some of the most common and most important safety issues when it comes to fire. The very first thing is notification, the smoke alarms. Now, we've changed the smoke alarm issues, or the smoke alarm law here, to address some issues we've seen over the past few years. We've had a smoke alarm in effect since 1994 in the state. And we've also required them in public buildings for more than 30 years. But there's still folks out there that have very old alarms. They're not being maintained. They don't understand how they work, or have disconnected them because they keep going off every time mother burns the toast. So some of the newest regulations, I have it broken down into two categories. So the first category is a single-family owner-occupied residence. Now, a lot of folks have a hard time understanding where these come from. Because the division does not regulate a single family owner-occupied home, it is covered under a state law. So this is the copy of the state law, and it breaks it into two categories. Either it's a new home or it's an existing home with different construction dates. It kind of changes some of the requirements. So basically, if someone's building a home today, they're required to install a photoelectric only style of a detector. Now, that is a technology that has come out from the last probably 10 years. There's basically two types of detection methods. There's an ionization and a photoelectric. And what has been studied and done is they're finding that the photoelectric style detector is reacting much quicker to a smoldering type fire. The ionization works for a flaming style of a fire. So back where I said the number one cause in the state of Vermont was heating, that's kind of what we're trying to address there when we're trying to get photoelectric installed. So basically they need to be installed in the vicinity of any bedrooms. They need to be installed on each level of the dwelling. And then there also is a requirement for carbon monoxide detection in there too, in the vicinity of the bedroom. They will be powered by the electrical service in the building and a battery. The battery acts as a backup power. So on to slide 11, which is existing. Basically what happens when someone transfers or sells a home, that is when they need to upgrade their smoke detection. Generally it'll be a detector in the vicinity of the bedrooms, and it must be a photoelectric at that time. There they allow either. They allow it to either be powered by the electrical service in the building or by battery. Then further down you see some dates. Anything constructed before January 1st, 1994 has to contain detectors powered by the electrical service and by battery. If it was constructed before that date, they can use either. So on to the next section, slide on 12, slide 12. That is a 1 and 2 family rental dwelling, an apartment, condo, or multifamily dwelling. Now that is the term we use, what we call public building. And by the state definition in there, it's basically any building that is not owner occupied. So there again, they give you different options depending on the dates. And basically anything that gets installed new has to be upgraded to that photoelectric. The locations are pretty much the same in the vicinity of the sleeping areas. Now sometimes the requirements for new, they're building a new, they have to install them also in the bedrooms on each level, and they have to be interconnected. So what that means is if the detector downstairs next to the furnace goes off, the one upstairs in the bedroom also goes off. That's what the interconnection means. Let's see here. So there again, those have to be AC powered. That's a new. On the next slide, it covers the existing. They're allowed to be either. There again, anything that's installed new has to be a photoelectric style. Basically, they need to be installed in the sleeping rooms other than a 1 and 2 family dwelling. There again, we're talking a rental dwelling here, not a single family owner occupied home. In the vicinity of the bedrooms and one on each level. There again, if we go in and do an inspection on this property and see that they're not being maintained, we can require them to install an electric detector with a battery backup and interconnection at that time. But there again, they have basically, if you go in and push the detector and nothing happens, push the test button on the detector and nothing happens, then we got an issue there. So we need to make that as safe as we can for folks. A couple of quick notes on the next slide. We've had some questions about, they make a combination detector, ionization and photoelectric. Those are not acceptable. And the reason being is the other issue with the ionization detector is they're more susceptible to false alarming. There again, the burning of the toast sets them off much more easy than the than the photoelectric detectors. So we're also trying to eliminate people trying to disable them and taking them apart and removing the battery. They do make a photoelectric and carbon monoxide combination detector, and that's fine. You can use that. So there again, there's some other pieces of it there talking about bed and breakfast style residences, family daycare homes. There's some specific language just for those. There is a technology out there that allows you to interconnect detectors with a little module that gets wired in. And it's a radio frequency module, and that is acceptable as long as it is what we call a listed device, which has been tested by either UL or FM or any of those companies. Another point that the manufacturers have come out and done a lot of research on is detectors over 10 years old need to be replaced. And basically what's happening is after 10 years, the smoke detectors are reducing the sensitivity that they have. So they're looking at that as the life of the detector. Carbon monoxide detection is a little bit different. That is a little bit less. Most of those are 5 years. And usually there's a date on the back of the detector, on the label. If there isn't a date on there, it's definitely over 10 years old, because it's been 10 years now since they've required to have the dates on them. So the next slide is carbon monoxide alarms. There again, this came into effect a couple years ago here when we had a incident at some UVM housing. We have had this issue for quite a few years, and it took quite a while to get folks to realize there was an issue and take care of it legislatively. There's some common symptoms that folks should be aware of. Generally, if they're feeling flu-like symptoms when they're at home or ill, and it gets better when they're away from the home, that's a good indicator that there's possibly a carbon monoxide issue in there. Carbon monoxide itself is colorless, odorless, and you can't tell it's there unless you have a carbon monoxide detector, and it will detect high levels of or sustained levels of carbon monoxide in a home. So there again, those are required to be located near the sleeping areas, because the biggest issue that we have found over the years is that folks go to sleep and they have a carbon monoxide issue in their house and never realize it's there, and they don't wake up. And so this is an attempt to try and get them to wake up and get out and take action. Some folks think, well, we'll put it down next to the furnace because that's where the biggest problem is going to be. There's actually information from the manufacturer that gives you a minimum distance it has to be away from the furnace, because you do get natural carbon monoxide puffs kind of in out of a furnace anyway. And the detector is trying to make sure that we don't go over the acceptable levels. On the next slide, in 17, you see some locations of detectors. The best location, of course, is in the center of the room, because basically what we're trying to do is we're trying to place that detector in the path of the smoke would travel. You also see there's a corner marking on that room that's depicted in the slide there that says dead air space. And basically we want to try and keep the detectors out of those areas, because as the air flows in the room and the smoke flows in the room, it's not going to go into that area, so it needs to... We need to have some areas out there. So 4 inches away from the sidewall, 4 inches down from a ceiling if you're mounting it on a sidewall, but not more than 12 inches down. So that's kind of the rule that the code sets for the placement. There is a lot of questions about carbon monoxide detection. Should we mount it high? Should we mount it low? That actually does not, carbon monoxide detection does not require a level to be mounted. Because basically carbon monoxide has the same specific density as air does, a little bit different, but it's a little bit less, but it's it basically flows with the air. So it's kind of mixes equally in the house, you know, from the air movement. So there's not really it's not going to collect low or build up high. So that's the point there. A couple other points. On the next slide, on slide number 18, it talks about second means of escape. Now that we have these folks warned that there is an issue in their house, we need to be able to get them out of the house. Now, the big rule is that there needs to be two ways out of every room. So their normal way, their number one way, would be the door leading to the room or from the room. We have to have an escape route. So that's what this second means of escape is all about. Now, we're allowed to use a window as a means of escape, but it's got to be sized properly. So anything smaller than a 5 square foot open area is not able to be considered a means of escape. And then if they're putting new in, it needs to be 5.7. Now, we get a lot of questions, well, you know, I can break the window out with a chair or something like that if I need to get out, or if the firemen are coming, they're gonna take an axe to it and break it out. Basically, what studies have shown is there needs to be only two actions for those folks to be able to get out of that room. And that's basically unlocking the window and raising it up if it's a double hung window and be able to get out. So that's, and then there's also some different heights requirements. You gotta be able to get it, still, you know, be able to use it and be able to bail out basically out of that window. So there again, these are just the tip of the iceberg, shall we say. There is much more detail that is available in there. So moving on to slide 19. Extension cords are a huge issue. The big thing on extension cords is the cord has to be sized properly for the equipment it's powering. And sometimes you have to look at the manufacturer of that equipment, such as a microwave. A microwave cannot be put on an extension cord. The microwave itself has to be plugged directly into an outlet because of the amount of power it draws. It will generally overheat a cord unless you have a real huge extension cord. A couple other points there. They can't be nailed to the wall. They can't go through windows or doors or stuff like that. They got to be protected from physical damage. So on slide 20, we talk a little bit about stairs, guards, and handrails. This is a huge issue for the insurance industry. This is a majority of their claims when they're talking about falls and injuries and stuff like that. Basically, a guard is required on any vertical drop over 30 inches. So if there's a front porch on the property or something like that, and the drop is more than 30 inches down, there needs to be a guard that is put in there, or a rail, handrail type of rail to prevent falls from over the thing. And it's got to be 42 inches high, which seems very high. And there's a reason that it is that high on a new construction like that. At 42 inches, it is very hard to sit on that rail. You basically have to jump up to it to be able to sit on it. And that's some of the research that they found, is that they can't, you know, people come up and they just sit on the rail and they fall over the edge. So they tried to engineer a safeguard in there. And there again, there's some requirements for the stairs, existing and new. There is a lot of detail on stairs, but basically they basically have to be a even type of a climb. It can't be an uneven type of a setup. So if someone's coming down, it doesn't change their normal step as they're going through it. There again, the handrails. There's some distances there for existing and new. One of the other big issues we find is housekeeping. We have not a huge issue, but we have some folks that don't want to get rid of anything, and it gets to a point where it becomes a actual fire hazard as well as a health hazard. So there is some rules in the code about that. So that's, and there is, like I said, there is a lot more issues that we do have in the code. So on slide 22, you see resources for you. Our webpage has a section in there that it is a huge resource for you folks. It's called the Code Information Sheets. And basically that details a lot more of some of the issues we've talked about today, but some of the other issues too that are code related. Basically it puts it into layman's terms of how the codes are enforced and detailed. Some of the measurements and stuff like that. Basically what we found is the inspector can go out and tell somebody how to do it, but once they leave, do they really remember, you know, the actual details? But so that's designed to help that. Those are all downloadable. We are working to put more up there too. And there again, there is some other web pages there that will give you some more details. So I realize we went through that very fast, and I'm sure there is tons of different questions. You do have my contact information on the front slide there, so feel free if you got a specific question after the session today, give me a holler and we can look at in more depth of your situation that you have or something like that.
So does anybody have questions?
I have a question. I want to know if carbon monoxide detectors are required in rental units that, you know, were built like in 1990, or is it just for units that are built now?
The only time that they cannot be installed is in a single-family owner-occupied home. The requirement for any rental housing or multifamily housing, they do have to be installed. There was a transition period that we were allowing folks to time to put them in and get them up to date, but that has now passed. So yes, any rental property does require smoke detection and carbon monoxide detection to be installed.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Mike?
Yes.
Does that include an owner-occupied duplex?
Oh.
Sorry.
So the owner is occupying one side and renting the other side?
Yes.
Yeah, it's basically what they say is one and two family home. So yes, that is considered a two family home. So even though it is a rental property, it still does require the carbon monoxide and smoke detection to be there. There is some requirements on the smoke detection side that they're allowed to get out of, such as installing them in the bedrooms. They're not required to do that. The AC power part of it does change also. Mainly if they're if the unit is being sold, that is usually the point where a lot of folks are doing the upgrading. Sometimes it's by their lender, the banks. A lot of the banks are requiring for them to get funding that it has to be up to date and stuff like that. So that's kind of where the requirement is coming in. The insurance companies are also looking at that, and they are also using what's adopted in the state code as their requirement too. So there's a couple of different areas where it can come into play.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions?
Just a quick one. A home that's heated with wood, is that more likely to have a fire, would you say?
Well, there again, there's some detailed prevention measures that folks can take. There is a whole nother book just on solid fuel devices. The most common issue that we run into is the clearances. The wood stoves that folks use generally are a much older style stove, and there's some specific clearances that have to be maintained to any combustible. And that goes all the way up into the chimney and stuff like that. So from the stove itself, there needs to be 36 inches of clearance to a combustible. Now that's a wall, that's a chair with clothes on it to dry, that's all that. So that is majority of what the issue that we find is the maintenance. Over the last 2 years, I want to say, we've seen a tremendous increase in the use of pellet style stoves and alternative fuel style stoves. Really, what you have to do is look at the manufacturer's instructions on those, because that is much, they have much different clearances and much different maintenance procedures that have to be followed. It's not just brushing the chimney and brushing the stove itself. There's some really detailed orifices in that stove that need to be kept clean for the air to get through. So that kind of gets thrown right back to the manufacturer on that one.
Thanks.
Okay. If there aren't any other questions, we'll go on to a brief discussion about pandemic flu and what the town health officer roles are. And I'd like to thank you, Mike, for coming today and presenting this information.
No problem at all.
Thanks.
And we are actually discussing some other ways to do other fire safety with a little bit more detailed, maybe another, you know, little training session, maybe in cooperation with leagues and cities and towns or something like that. So stay tuned, I guess.
Okay, so we have Susan Schoenfeld, who's an infectious disease epidemiologist and nurse, and the head of our EPI field unit here, who would like to take a few minutes to briefly describe what the state has been doing for pandemic flu, and then to ask you what you think your roles could be.
Hi, thanks a lot. Well, we've been involved for a long time in planning what we call community mitigation, measures that can be taken on a community level to lessen the impact of an influenza outbreak in a community. We know that an ultimate goal in preventing flu is having flu vaccine available. With this current, I'm going to assume everybody has at least a little bit of knowledge about what's been going on since spring, that there was in the spring a new strain of flu identified. It caused outbreaks first in Mexico and the United States and then around the world, and this has been declared a pandemic by the World Health Organization. We had activity here in the spring. The summer's been much more quiet, although we've continued to have a few isolated cases, but it's the time of active flu season in the southern hemisphere, and we fully anticipate we'll be seeing cases again here in the fall. As part of our planning, we have been, and one of the tricky things in planning, I should say, is because this is such a new virus, we've been, the Centers for Disease Control is one of our main sources of guidance for communities and schools and hospitals and things like that. And there have been a lot of changes over time in the guidance, and just now at the end of the summer, they're coming out with a new school guidance came out August 5th, and actually today at 11 o'clock they were supposed to post new guidance for businesses and workplaces, and I haven't seen that yet. It is posted on the CDC website. We've had a couple discussions with Austin Sumner and Lori about town health officers, what we would think as your role in this fall when we expect to see more widespread community outbreaks, and how we can get information back out to you. We already do have scheduled for September 9th, which is the next one of these little trainings. That whole topic will be on flu. So what this little time is not meant to cover that. But I think what we would, as we've fleshed out in our own thinking, what we would like to work with town health officers on, and we're coming up with ways that we want to get that information and broader information out to you. We just thought this would be a good time to see if you have particular questions or concerns that we can be sure we address September 9th.
Hi, Susan, this is Sharon McDonald.
Hey, Sharon, hi.
How are you?
I'm good.
Is the vaccination planned? Is that two-stage two shots for the swine flu?
Yeah, the information that we have is we certainly are going to be strongly recommending and pushing that everybody get the normal seasonal vaccine, which is, except for very young children, it's one dose. The new vaccine for swine flu, which is undergoing clinical trials right now, will need to be given. The information we have now, which I doubt is going to change, is that people will need to get two doses of it. The first, since this is such a new virus, the first dose would be kind of a primer, and then a second dose, which would probably be 4 weeks later, is what would be needed for protection. And the information we have about vaccine availability right now is the earliest we expect to have any of the swine flu or the novel H1N1 is the more formal name. Yeah. Earliest we expect to have that is some of that is mid-October.
Right.
The exact amount we're going to get is up for question. The recent information we've had is that there's going to be less of the vaccine available than
right.
than the high expectations.
Right. Yeah, I gather that they are having trouble growing it.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, the advocacy that we would be doing is for people to be getting their seasonal vaccine, because in a sense, at this point, we don't even know who we'd be recommending to get the
right.
H1N1 or when it exactly would be available.
Right. And I could say that, you know, when the primary role that we see for town health officers with the flu outbreak is really being a source of information for your town officials and your community up to the level that you are available and comfortable doing. And so that means our primary role here is to be sure that we get you information about what is what's happening and what actions that are going to be taking place that affect the community. And that is, some of that information is rolling out. And I think, you know, what Sharon's saying about, you know, we will get information about who is eligible for the amount of the novel flu vaccine, which will be a limited supply at first. But any efforts that town health officers can make and first of all, understanding very well themselves the importance of the seasonal flu vaccine and then helping to be able to explain and encourage other people to get that vaccine, that would be great because there's no anticipated shortage of the seasonal flu vaccine.
And we're still keeping that to people over a certain age with pre-existing medical illnesses? Are they pushing down the ages or anything?
I think that the recommendations for the seasonal flu vaccine are going to be, to my knowledge, going to be the same that they always were with priority groups and being people over 65 and people with underlying health issues. But over the past several years, all pregnant women and children have been recommended to have the vaccine as well. So really, at this point, the vaccine is strongly recommended for big groups of people and generally recommended as a good idea for others. So.
Yeah.
But we will certainly, as the information about seasonal flu becomes available, make sure we get that to town health officers so that you can have that information.
Okay. Do you anticipate that the regional office will all vaccination be going through physicians, or will the health department be providing vaccine clinics?
As far as we know right now, and things are still in flux, it's going to be a mixture.
Okay.
There are some priority groups, for example, pregnant women are a priority group for the novel flu vaccine as well as for seasonal flu vaccine. And it may be that it really makes sense with that group of people who have regular medical appointments to get the vaccine with their doctor. If, in fact, there's enough vaccine to do all school-age children, and that is a priority group, depending on how quickly we get vaccine in, it would make sense to do vaccination in schools because there's just so many, it'd be hard to get them into their doctors. So my understanding right now is that depending on the quantity of vaccine, which will determine who the priority groups are to start with, there'll be different approaches to get the vaccine out efficiently. And what they are saying, CDC, is that the amount of vaccine, though, there may not be as much available to start off as would have been ideal, but we expect then to be getting regular shipments week after week. So instead of saying, well, there'll be certain people that won't be vaccinated, it will be, let's get the highest risk people done first and then continue to roll out vaccine to people. And, you know, it's going to be, so there will be vaccine available over time, just perhaps not as much available in the middle of October as would have been ideal.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. This is Justin. This is Peter Kay. I'm the Fairfax Town Officer. Mm-hmm. My company that I work for is I'm a specialist at EH&S. We have began a real large campaign for hygiene, proper hygiene. Is that something that we could start with in our own towns, maybe some information from you folks, giving it to our town fathers? And I think most towns have some kind of a local newspaper.
Yeah.
And begin that communication at this point,
absolutely.
Then grow into the next step of...
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the initial steps that everybody can take now that reduce your risk for all kinds of infections, including seasonal flu and this pandemic flu strain, is good hygiene. It's washing hands frequently, covering coughs, and a big one and a very challenging one for people to follow is staying home when you're sick. You know, I think we all have cultures where, you know, that it's people are expected to come to work, you know, and fight through whether you're ill or not. And if we can all just stop and think about, well, how much do you want to be sitting beside somebody with a fever and coughing? You know, we have to change our cultural thinking on the part of people and on the part of organizations and businesses in understanding it's really for their better good to, you know, make this to try to keep distance between people who are sick, and that usually that distance means that person should be at home. So the health department website is posting, has information right now about the steps you can take to reduce your risk of flu, including, actually, let me have Kathleen Horton from our communications offices here, and she can maybe just describe very briefly what's already posted for you to use as a resource, because all of these things you can start anytime. Kathleen, would you?
Sure. We do have some posters available about hand washing, also a poster about staying home when you're sick and covering your cough. Those are available as posters from your local health departments. They're also available on the website to download and to print out, and we'll also find some other fact sheets and information there.
Good.
And
we'll use that to communicate.
Yeah. And the CDC website, you know, we pretty quickly get information from the CDC website onto our health department website. But for example, this business guidance that was posted a couple hours ago, if at www.
www.flu.gov.
Okay.
And if you look, there's a guidance section, and that'll take you to, that. You know, they posted complete school guidance on August 5th. They just posted the business and workplace guidance. And we, a letter is just going out today from the, signed by the commissioners of the Department of Education and the Department of Health to all school administrators regarding the school guidance. And we're going to be providing information to school nurses. And really, the core of the initial information is all that the hygiene, stay home when you're sick. There's a couple details, but it all boils down to that, basically.
Good, very good.
And this is all, I should say, one caveat with that. The guidance, you know, the recommendations, for example, around schools are to keep schools open as much as possible and to emphasize these hygiene steps. There's a level of guidance we're providing right now, assuming that the flu strain that's circulating this fall is similar in severity to what we saw in the spring. If it happens to come back and become much more severe, there will be more implications for, there may be other measures that need to be considered. But so far, with the close monitoring being done by CDC and the World Health Organization in the Southern Hemisphere, this seems to be striking young people and young adults disproportionately, but it's not that coming in a striking severe fashion the way historically happened in 1918. Mm-hmm. So that's being monitored closely.
Okay, great.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah. And so, as I said, on September 9th, the whole presentation will be on just a pan flu update and roles of the town health officer, which, you know, as I said, number one is information, and you can start, the more you can become familiar with information and be a conduit of that to your town and city, that's great. And we're going to be looking at, we're coming up with some different steps to try to really support getting information out to the public and the community and different organizations, you know, getting it out promptly and clearly and in the most useful manner as possible.
Okay.
great.
So are there other, that's a great idea about passing out information. Are there ways that you might, like two businesses and two schools you suggested, are there other ways that you could suggest town health officers that we could propose that town health officers could get the information out in their communities? Like, are there big events that might take place? Or
We do community forums.
Okay.
It's been, this is just in the sort of the small area of Peacham, and it sort of includes West Barnet sometimes and various folks, but it is a place where, because people have been very curious about this, so we've had one community forum on it already, just because everybody was trying to figure out what, when WHO went up in their alert levels, you know, what was that, and sort of talking it through. So we would probably do something like that or offer to.
Okay.
I can imagine that. I don't know if things got more intense, if there are certain town health officers or people in the state that would be willing to do, if you were to have podcasts or something like that to sort of help inform people.
Yeah, we're just talking today, and that so the plans are in the works to make to be sure that we have easily accessible information for organizations. I mean, we've had, a lot of focus on individuals and the public, which we need to keep continuing and updating and getting out there. But we also want to make sure that cities, mm-hmm. towns, and workplaces and organizations are hearing information
right.
from their perspective about continuity of operations and to, you know, have a sense of being a little better prepared to expect what they might see in terms of illness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think also the amount of, right now I don't have a sense that people are real worried about it, so there's not this, you know, like you say, if the media began to cover it differently because either they just do or because the severity changed or the risk sense changed, then I can imagine there'd be a lot more interest in.
Okay, any other thoughts about town health officer roles or if you any description about what you're doing right now with the planning process? Okay, well, thanks for your time. Again, the next one is September 9th at 12:30 at the same time, and Susan will go into more detail on pandemic flu. And I appreciate you staying on longer. Thank you.
I appreciate that. We've had this really active discussion on the listserv,
mm-hmm.
and that's actually been very good. So that's my feedback.
Okay, thanks, great.
Thanks.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.